And welcome to another episode of Royals, Rebels, and Romantics. Sorry, I have a little bit of a cold, so I do have a cough drop in to keep me from coughing. So hopefully you'll still be able to understand me and we'll be able to move forward together. As we shift into November, we are very possibly still surrounded by Halloween decorations and some leftover Halloween candy. And we're still maybe thinking about witches and ghouls and all of those things that can be frightening at night, as often happens on Halloween. Now, we are also coming up to a night as we remember the 5th of November, where there were also some frightening things happening in the dark and in the night. And I think it's interesting to consider that Halloween, All Hallows Eve, when all the scary things are happening, and Guy Fawkes Day, Bonfire Night, they happen within a week of each other. Now, that's just something for us to think about. But as we consider what was going on at the time in England, when the gunpowder plot was being plotted and hatched, and there were rebellions and possible rebellions and all of that going on, not just in London, but in the Midlands as well. It is interesting to sort of take a look at those events through the eyes of someone who lived through them. And so, not surprisingly, I am turning to William Shakespeare, who created his own narrative about the potential of fright, of kings dying and being murdered, of witches and scary things happening. He created plays that allowed him to explore some of what was on people's minds, some of the fears that were going through people's minds. Catholics, Protestants, everyone. It was such an unsettling time. Now, as you know, when I'm not traveling and podcasting and meeting with some of you, as I love to do, one of the other things I do is speaking, and I speak about history and leadership. And one of the ways I love to do that is by looking at the person who so brilliantly combines the exploration of history and leadership, and that's Shakespeare. He was writing, of course, for people in his day. They were concerned about leadership, whether it was during the final years of the reign of Queen Elizabeth I and the whole succession worries, or the beginning of the reign of James I and what it meant now to have a Scottish king and all of that. Shakespeare could not, by law, address those questions and concerns head on. So what he did was he created plays, and he often turned to history to tell stories that were asking the questions that were puzzling and worrying people in his day. And those questions still resonate with us. So what we're going to do today is take a look at the surrounding time of the gunpowder plot and two plays that were created and first produced during that scary period of time, King Lear and Macbeth. Now, during the first years of the reign of James VI of Scotland, who became James I of England after Elizabeth died, the crown had smoothly transitioned, and Catholics in England were hopeful that maybe this was a sign that James coming to the throne would signal greater freedoms, greater religious worship opportunities, less persecution for Catholics. After all, James, of course, was the son of Mary, Queen of Scots, and many Catholics had actually thought Mary, Queen of Scots, should have been the Queen of England. And so surely her son, although he'd been raised as a Protestant, surely he would have some of her desire for the Catholic religion. It was also true that James's wife, Anne of Denmark, was thought to be privately practicing Catholicism. She certainly, in a public way, attended church services in the Scottish church with her husband. And when she came to England, she did the same. But there were a lot of indications that she might have had some sympathy, some empathy for Catholics, and that she might, in fact, help that transition where Catholics would not feel quite as persecuted as they had in the final years of Elizabeth's reign. And James himself had indicated that as long as Catholics worshiped quietly and behaved themselves and did not rebel against the government, that he would, in fact, be very hesitant to go after them, that he was willing not to persecute Catholics as long as they did not rebel against the government. However, the reality turned out to be quite different. Within a short time of taking the throne, in fact, King James was strengthening the laws that secured Protestantism. Of course, it means something different now than it did then, but the Church of England, as he had the Church of Scotland, that was the only acceptable religion. And in fact, in many ways, he became stricter than Elizabeth, who had personally not wanted to interfere. It was said of her, though not by her, that she didn't wish to make windows into men's souls. On the other hand, right from the start, James said, "Who can't pray with me can't love me." So he expected people to follow his religion, and he was not going to tolerate anything else. One of the Jesuit priests who was quite famous among the Catholics, very well known, Jean Girard, expressed bitter disappointment in this. And he said, quote, "A flash of lightning, giving for the time a pale light unto those that sit in darkness, doth afterwards leave them in more desolation." In other words, having had this hope of greater times, they were even more disappointed when it didn't work out that way. So fairly quickly, James's popularity among Catholics plummeted, and they became very suspicious of him as he was becoming suspicious of them. Now, Catholics weren't actually the only religious group who was frustrated with James. The Puritans, those who really wanted significant, dramatic reform, and who were less than impressed with the king's lifestyle, particularly him surrounding himself with so many young men and spending very little time with his wife. So the Puritans weren't very happy with James either. And interestingly, the Catholics and the Puritans actually formed an unlikely union to protest in the Bye plot, in 1603, just months after James came to the throne. The idea was both groups wanted greater religious toleration. They wanted him to give greater allowance for different ways of worshiping. So both the Puritans and the Catholics, now their way of worshiping was very different, but they both wanted to be able to worship. And so they got together. The plot was to kidnap James as he came down to London and force him to eliminate the fines for recusancy, which was not attending the Anglican services, and remove some of his ministers who had been particularly eager to persecute these groups. It was considered the Bye plot because it was part of a larger plot. But just looking at that Bye plot, it fell apart. It just didn't come to anything. They weren't able to do it. It just petered out very quickly. But the fact that quickly there were religious groups working against James and dissatisfied right from the start with his religious policy is an indication that worse is to come. Now, the main plot associated with that was larger, and its goal was to actually force James off the throne and replace him with Arabella Stuart. She was another of the Tudor descendants. She was the great-granddaughter of Margaret Tudor, which makes her the great-great-granddaughter of Henry VII. She had a clear claim to the throne through Margaret Tudor, and some in England made the case that she had a better claim to the throne than James did because, of course, James was born and raised in Scotland, a foreign country. Arabella Stewart, on the other hand, had been born and raised in England, and some people thought that made her a better choice. Not that they were really eager to have another queen. The plan was to marry her very quickly off to a Catholic prince and thereby restore Catholicism. That did not work either. There were a couple of people, somewhat prominent people, who were involved in that plot. Henry Brooke, Lord Cobham, was involved in that plot and was arrested. Also, Sir Walter Raleigh, who had been a favorite of Elizabeth I, was involved in that plot and was arrested and put in the Tower. He was one of the most famous and the most long-lasting prisoner. He was there for 13 years before he was let out for just a short time to do something for James. And then when that didn't work, he was put back in and executed. So again, even though these plots didn't work, it was an indication that James's decision not to allow Catholicism to be practiced was already being met with resistance. So the Catholics wanted more freedom of religion, and the really fervent Puritans on the other end of the spectrum wanted more freedom of religion. Now, James was very involved in his religious policies and practices. In fact, straight away early in his reign, he held a council and he invited religious discussion. And, you know, some people were satisfied with that, but the Catholics and the Protestants, the really fervent Puritans, still wanted more. The other thing James did, as you know, was he sponsored a new translation of the Bible, and the King James Version of the Bible became a bestseller and still is. So he did do some very specific things. He wanted himself to be seen as this very religious king. The other thing he really wanted to happen was to unite the nations of England and Scotland. His view was, after all, the crowns of England and Scotland were united in him, so why not unite the nations? He said to the English Parliament, quote, "Hath God not made us one island, compassed with one sea, and of itself by nature indivisible?" Well, the king didn't understand the resistance, both in England and in Scotland, and the populations of both countries were not really interested in the union that James envisioned. The people of England, at least the leaders and their spokespeople, thought, well, if we are going to unite, then Scotland would just need to kind of be absorbed into England, so it would just be England. Well, Scotland wasn't interested in that. Scotland was insisting that if there was a union, they'd be seen as their own country and that they would be equal partners. And so there was no agreement there. And James did run into a lot of resistance there as well. He wanted to be known as the King of Great Britain. And so he issued a proclamation that he would be known by divine right as the King of Great Britain. There was resistance to that. And he was declaring things that the parliaments of both countries were not willing to carry out. So there was a lot of resistance to what James wanted. There was resistance to his religious beliefs. There was resistance to his insisting on an even stricter adherence to very narrowly divided religious laws. He was deciding how people should worship. And this, all of this together led to other rebellions, most specifically the Gunpowder Plot. There are many ways of telling the Gunpowder Plot, and even today, not all historians agree. So let's just look at some of the basics and see what we can tease out about what did, or in some cases, might have happened. English Catholics were starting to realize that because James had come down as a king, sort of in his prime, and he already had a son and heir that was being raised up in the same religion, at least at that time, it was clear that Catholicism was in trouble, and English Catholics realized that their lives and their religion was at stake, so they had to take matters into their own hand. Robert Catesby, who was a member of a minor gentry family, decided that the great plan would be to bring barrels of gunpowder into the cellars of Westminster Hall, and when Protestant Parliament, it was largely Protestant Parliament, met And at the opening of Parliament, the king would be there to open Parliament. There would be an explosion. And it would wipe out the king. It would wipe out these Protestant members of Parliament. Then they would be able to sort of step up and ensure Catholics were in charge. At the same time, there would be a Catholic rebellion in the Midlands that was planned. So these two points of Catholic control, they would then get James's young daughter, Elizabeth, make her sort of a puppet queen. And again, that plan, marry her off to a Catholic prince who would bring the country back to Catholicism. So that was the plot, as it was later described. Now, Westminster at the time was a very busy place. So now if you try to go on a tour of Westminster Hall, you have to be scanned, you have to be a member of a tour, you have to have a ticket, lots of security. That was not the case then. And so this group of people was able to actually rent a room very close to the hall where everyone would be. And then because they had access to that room, they were able, it was underneath, it was a cellar, they were able to bring these barrels of gunpowder in. And they believed that that would happen. They were able to bring the gunpowder in. Someone would be there at the right time, would light all of these barrels afire. It would be a huge explosion and take down the Parliament government. So why did it fail? That was the plot. Why did it fail? There are several reasons it failed. One was a lack of foreign support. So initially, Catesby and his other conspirators thought, this is great. We know that Spain and Rome and the Habsburg Empire, all these people were so eager to put Mary, Queen of Scots on the throne and have England become a Catholic nation. They'll support us too. Well, it turns out that Philip III of Spain, the son of Elizabeth's great nemesis, was not really interested in being at war with England anymore. And James was reaching out to settle a peace agreement with Spain, and Philip was really more interested in that. And so he wasn't willing to support the conspirators and blow up the country and blow up the king. He preferred to try peace for a while. And other foreign nations sort of had the same feeling, where they're just going to kind of they were willing to wait and see what really happened in England. So there wasn't foreign support. So the backers didn't get that, which they needed. But the key, sort of the turning point of the failure of the plot, was an anonymous letter that was sent to a Catholic peer, William Parker, who was Lord Monteagle. So it's called the Monteagle letter. And it warned him that he should, quote, shift off your attendance at this Parliament, for God and man hath concurred to punish the wickedness of this time. I say they shall receive a terrible blow at this Parliament. So the author of the letter was letting Monteagle know, this is really dangerous, don't go there. Now, Monteagle had previously been unhappy with the way Catholics were treated. That had brought him under some suspicion in James's government. So instead of remaining under suspicion, Monteagle decided, okay, great. I have this letter. I will show it to the authorities, and that will get me in better standing with the government. So he immediately took the letter to Robert Cecil. And Cecil took the letter, and the king was out of town. When the king came back, Cecil showed the letter to the king. And they investigated and found 36 barrels of gunpowder and a man standing there guarding the gunpowder, ready to light it. And that, of course, was Guy Fawkes. So that's how he comes in. He was not the leader, but he was the one standing there. So the question is, who wrote the letter? Who was trying to warn off Monteagle, not realizing he'd turn them in? Some think it was Francis Tresham. He was a newcomer to the plotters, and he was concerned that there would be such a high loss of life if this plot went through of Catholics as well as Protestants. And he just felt like it was too much. And so some people think he decided to stop it. He wanted to do something, but not something like that to stop it. The other part of that story is his sister was married to Monteagle. So if it's going to blow up, he certainly doesn't want Monteagle to be blown up too. He wanted to protect his sister. Some people think that maybe Monteagle himself knew about the plot and wrote an anonymous letter to himself, giving himself an opportunity to gain the favor of the king. Some people even think that Robert Cecil had found out about it, or perhaps encouraged or allowed the plot to continue, and then wrote the letter to give him a way of stopping it that still allowed him to catch in the act all these Catholic plotters, which may have been something Cecil wanted to do. So whatever was behind the letter, it worked and it stopped the plot. So there was no explosion. No one was blown up. No one was killed. And the king and the government realized this was an opportunity to create a narrative of what if. And that would take advantage of the horrible potential, not having actual loss of life, but to whip up resistance to the Catholic movement and allow them to enact these much more serious laws. What if the plotters had succeeded? What if the king had been murdered? What if Parliament had been blown up? What if all these terrible things had happened? Wouldn't that have been awful? Would anarchy have prevailed? Would the country have sunk into a civil war? Would foreign nations have easily been able to invade? And that's where we bring Shakespeare right into our conversation, because in this time of terror, people were very unsettled by this. The idea that something could have happened right at the heart of government that could have wiped out the royal family, the king, and Parliament, and left the country in that vulnerable position did cause a lot of concern among people. And so Shakespeare was right in the middle of that, right in London, doing what he always did, observing, listening, paying attention, and recognizing what people were hoping for, what people were dreading, what was on their minds, what they wanted to explore somehow, what they wanted to see acted out and vicariously participate in to help them make sense of the world around them. So James Shapiro wrote this great book, 1606, The Year of Lear. And in the book, it says this, quote, "The theater was the one place where rich and poor could congregate and see enacted through made-up stories a refracted image of their own desires and anxieties." So the theater, and especially this is true of Shakespeare, he could act out and help people make sense of these things through made-up stories. So in the days and weeks leading up to the gunpowder plot, where there was all of this turmoil, and then especially afterwards, Shakespeare has been working on a play. He has turned to an old play, King Lear. It had been acted by the Queen's Men in the 1580s. The Queen's Men, of course, performed under the watchful eye of another government official, Francis Walsingham, Elizabeth's spymaster. And he did use theater to promote the cause of the Queen. And also in those days, sending companies around to all kinds of places in England where they could be Walsingham's eyes and ears to see what was happening. And there is a possibility, we know that the Queen's Men came through Stratford and that Shakespeare may very well have seen some of their productions in the 1580s. He may, we don't know this, but he may have joined them. One of their players had recently been killed. And so when they came to Stratford, they were a person short, and somehow Shakespeare got into the theater world. So it may have been there then. We don't know that. But in any case, he looked at King Lear, which was really part of a discussion of succession. It was an existing story. It was one people knew. And Shakespeare was now part of the king's men, part of James's men. And so in the midst of all of the work James was going through to try and unite England and Scotland and call it Britain, and he's declaring himself the King of Britain. During that time, 1604, 1605, 1606, as he's creating Lear, mainly in 1605, Shakespeare reaches back to an older play. Lear was a king of Britain before England and Scotland were separated. And so this idea of a union and the splitting up of a union, of course, in Lear, the personal is political. So you have a father dealing with daughters, but it is the king dealing with potential heirs, and he is splitting up the kingdom among his heirs. He's also using language and abusing language because he's saying to his daughters, tell me what I want you to say, and I will give you power. If you don't say what I want you to say, I will give you nothing. So this idea of a transactional relationship in a conversation between a father and a daughter, but also between a leader and a potential future leader. Don't tell me the truth. Only tell me what I want to hear. Shakespeare uses that tale as a starting point, but he twists and turns it. And Cecil, would have seen, people in England would have seen, there are questions about power and transfer of power and transition. Lear's goal is not truth, it's praise. Is that true of James as well? James certainly loved to be praised. Is that how he was being managed? And you see, if the monarch's only after praise, it doesn't work. And in Shakespeare's play in particular, Goneril and Regan do not give what they promise. They just get what they can. Because if you're transactional, eventually it falls apart. Now, Shakespeare started with a play where people expected to see a particular ending. Audiences knew the story. They knew how it worked out in the old versions of King Lear. 1580s wasn't that long ago. But Shakespeare denies them that ending. It's a happy ending in the previous version of the play. All right. Lear and Cordelia go off together. That's not what happens in Shakespeare's play. His Lear, Shakespeare's Lear, takes us further into the depths of tragedy and desolation. He writes from the world that's been upended around him, with the audiences having this great what if desolation comes? What if everything falls apart? Acted out for them on stage. Basically, Lear has abused his authority and created a nightmare. And his leadership at the end of the play, we have sort of the typical with Shakespeare's stage full of dead bodies. What might have happened if the gunpowder plot had succeeded? We would have had a country. We would have had the heart of government full of dead bodies. So Shakespeare is tapping into that. That was the fear he was playing on. And he invites Londoners to consider that. So on the days after the 5th of November, when the plot had been thwarted, but people were finding out more and more about it, people were wondering what still could happen. And a Venetian ambassador said this, quote, "The city is in great uncertainty. Catholics fear heretics and vice versa. Both are armed." Now, the lack of union isn't just about England and Scotland. Within the nation itself, within England itself right now, there is splintering and there is disintegration. And in King Lear, there is splintering and division of a kingdom. And then those sides turn on each other. So the explosion of those 36 barrels of gunpowder would have wiped out more than just the king and parliament. It would have been such a big explosion, it would have destroyed London. It's estimated it would have killed thousands and thousands and possibly tens of thousands of people. It would have been unimaginable for the people of the time. And the aftershocks would have spread throughout the country. The king and his council made sure that the aftershocks of what didn't happen spread through the country. They used language to make sure their version of what had happened and what could have happened really gripped the country. The king himself addressed the political and religious leaders, and he said that the plot had targeted all of them and, quote, a destruction prepared not for me alone, but for you all that are here present, and wherein no rank, age, nor sex should have been spared. So his speech was given to those leaders, but then it was printed and it was distributed widely. So everyone had a chance to see that they themselves could have been directly affected, hurt, or killed by this event. The point was to make the nation imagine this terrible, horrifying, devastating thing, the death of kings, the death of leaders. And that's what Shakespeare was doing. So it was an exercise. Lear ended up being an exercise in the imagination, because one of the things that sets the gunpowder plot apart from other attacks is that eventually nothing happened. Nothing blew up. But that nothing was also played with by Shakespeare and Lear. He, in the play, Lear himself counsels Cordelia to mend her speech because, quote, nothing can come of nothing. And the play proves that that's not true, because in a transactional conversation, actually, Goneril and Regan offer Lear nothing, and he gives them a third of the kingdom. So a third of the kingdom for each of them came from their nothing. They gave him nothing true and nothing meaningful. And when he needed something from them, they gave him nothing. Cordelia's speech may seem like nothing to Lear because he doesn't understand. But in fact, when she says, I love you according to my bond, that truth later demonstrates itself to mean everything to him. So Shakespeare is also playing with the idea of nothing. And in fact, with the gunpowder plot, that nothing happened became more powerful. The aftermath of nothing really gave the government an opportunity to be more powerful than the event itself. So as 1605 turns into 1606, there were versions of the plot, and people on the continent were wondering, did this even really happen? What's going on here? So the king was looking at this, was looking at the Catholics, was looking at some of these radical Puritans, and they were criticizing him and his lifestyle, and there were divisions everywhere. And so Cecil was the one who started reviewing all of the confessions that had been gathered, and he used those, some of them, of course, gathered by torture. He used those confessions to create a narrative that supported the government's position. And that's when we see, it isn't until Cecil's version where we see Guy Fawkes or Guido Fawkes really become identified as the villain of the story. He was really not a key figure until he was created into being a key figure. And some of the plotters had already been executed and buried. Well, in 1606, those bodies were exhumed and their heads were cut off and they were placed on spikes. And so it was this retroactive punishment, this very public look at these terrible people kind of things. And then the eight plotters who were still alive, including Guy Fawkes, were tried, and their trial was made public so everyone could see all the evidence against them. And of course, the guilty verdict was guaranteed. And then their executions, again, were public and grisly. And London was even more unsettled because now you have these body parts everywhere. And in Parliament, when it met in January of 1606, it called for a commemoration of what became Bonfire Night, but a commemoration, a Thanksgiving service to be thankful that all these terrible plots were thwarted. And so it's really interesting that fervor with which they pursued what could have happened and our gratitude that all these terrible things didn't happen was actually put into law and commemorated and revisited yearly. Now, King Lear is first performed shortly after the gunpowder plot. And it ends with a destruction. In his play, it doesn't end happily. It ends with a destruction of the royal family. And near the end of the play, Kent, really interesting character, Kent asks, is this the promised end? And Edgar replies, or image of that horror. Those ideas, a promised end and images of horror, would have been especially powerful and horrifying to playgoers at Shakespeare's time. And again, that's who he's writing for. So as Lear is playing and audiences are just kind of horrified by it, Shakespeare is turning to his next project, which is Macbeth. And I can say that because I'm not in a theater. I'm just in my house. And he dives even deeper into the unrest that's continuing. And he's deliberately evoking witches, something that fascinates King James and horrifies King James. He's the only monarch to write a whole treatise going after witches. So he's really concerned about that. The play, Macbeth, begins and ends with the killing of a king. And again, continues to, you know, make use of that fear that is being constantly stoked by the government. When we meet the witches at the very beginning of the play, it talks about thunder and lightning. And it's possible in Shakespeare's time that the explosions that were in the theater, those small explosions to make the noise of thunder and make it feel like lightning, would have been created from brimstone and saltpeter, which would have smelled like gunpowder. Again, reminding everybody of gunpowder. So that was a pretty disturbing kind of image. Now, in Macbeth, Shakespeare directly takes on something very associated with the gunpowder plot and other Catholic plots, which is the issue of equivocation. That's the manipulation of language within 1606 that completely was understood to mean an intent to deceive. So a book had been found in a search of some of the Catholic potential plotters, and Edward Cook was one of the ones who found the book. It was found at the Inner Temple, which is a special place in the English government. It was supposed to be sort of a place of law and study and where things were just right. And instead, it contained this book. And this is what Edward Cook wrote when he found the book. This book containing 61 pages, I found in a chamber in the Inner Temple where Sir Thomas Tresham used to lie. And he's one of the plotters. When he obtained for his sons. And it was originally titled A Treatise of Equivocation, and then renamed A Treatise of Lying and Fraudulent Equivocation. And so the idea was you would manipulate language. The first way was to use ambiguous words. So if you said something like, this priest lieth not in my father's home. And what you mean by lieth not is he's not telling lies, but in fact, he is staying there and lying down at night. But you're using a different form of the word lying. So you're using ambiguous language. The second way is to omit a bit of information. So if you are going to visit a neighbor's and you say that you visited a neighbor's home for dinner, and that's all you say, you also happen to attend a Catholic service, but you leave that part out. So you just tell part of the story. A third way is hiding a gesture. Now, we see that sometimes as someone making a promise and behind their back, they're crossing their fingers. Okay, that is spelled out in the Book of Equivocation, that you do something that's not seen, a gesture that changes the meaning of what you've just said. And the fourth way is you say part of the story and then finish the sentence in your head. So you might say to the authorities that I have never seen the priest. And the rest of the sentence is, I've never seen the priest. And in your mind, you're finishing the sentence standing behind the door. Nope, I've never seen him stand behind the door. And all the authorities get to hear is, I've never seen the priest. And it's not a lie because God knows what's in your head. So he knows what you're really saying is you have never seen the priest stand behind a door. So this is an instruction book for how Catholics can give evidence without being accused of lying and without their immortal souls being in any jeopardy, because they're not really lying. they're equivocating. And so that phrase has really taken on this resonance. And so an audience of that time, when Macbeth says, "I pull in resolution and begin to doubt the equivocation of the fiend that lies like truth." That phrase about equivocation would mean so much to playgoers at the time. Sometimes today it's lost. People don't respond to it, but it really does mean something. And we see equivocation throughout Macbeth, and it's especially true of the witches when they reassure Macbeth, "None of woman born shall harm Macbeth." He thinks, "Oh, good, everyone's born of woman. No one can hurt me." Well, later it turns out that Macbeth was untimely ripped from his mother's womb. So, yep, he's going to hurt you. And then the witches say to Macbeth, "Macbeth shall never be vanquished until great Birnam Wood to high Dunsinane shall come against him." Well, okay, Dunsinane is here. Birnam Wood is here. Can't move. I'm fine, Macbeth thinks. I'm going to be good. But it turns out some of the soldiers are hiding behind pieces of wood that they brought from Birnam Wood, and they're coming toward Dunsinane. And in other words, the witches have equivocated, and it is to Macbeth's destruction. That's what equivocation leads to in the play. So Edward Cook realized the potential destruction that's associated with this manipulation of language, because these words can actually tear apart the society. And we see that in Macbeth. The words are the weapons that are used long before the daggers get involved. And so the idea, it's part of an invasion of ideas that started back in Elizabeth's time when Jesuit priests were disguised. They were coded. There were messages being sent in cipher and code. There were people being sent in cipher and code. They were coded as others. They were coming in disguise. The houses were disguised. They were including built-in priest holes to hide the priests. And this is now gone forward to the very language that people are using being coded as all of these people are struggling to make sense of the world around them. It's easy to imagine how theater goers look at plays like King Lear and Macbeth, and it resonates with the notion of what happens when a king is killed, because in the plays where these kings die, it doesn't go well. It's a terrible, terrifying time. And as they leave the theater, having seen this acted on stage, of course, not what's happening today. Oh, no, no, that would be illegal to have on stage. This is an old version. But to see their very fears acted out on stage, and then they leave the theater and they walk past the rotting heads of traitors that are up on spikes all around them. And so all of this is happening on stage, all around them, in their minds, in their language, during this period of time. And so when we look at 1605 and 1606, I think one of the ways to really understand the level of terror that was going on, particularly in London, not just in members of government and the royals, but in the people themselves, the unsettled, frightened, not sure what's happening next, the ground seems to be shifting. All of those thoughts and feelings we can get at, I think, when we look at Shakespeare's plays and how he evokes the very worries that are keeping people up at night and explores them on stage, giving people that as a tool. So I think double, toil and trouble isn't that far removed from what becomes a modern chant to remember the 5th of November. There are ways that history shows us what's possible. And in 1605 and 1606, Shakespeare gives voice to those terrors, the terrors of the time, in plays that continue to enthrall us and that speak to us today about other concerns and other possibilities and what could happen today, what else could go wrong. And that is one of the ways that Shakespeare really gives voice to that powerful way that history shows us what's possible. Thank you so much for joining me, for listening to my thoughts on these plays during this particularly interesting time. I would love to know what you think, so please reach out. I also want to give a big shout out and thank you to my wonderful patrons who continue to support me. If you are interested in joining the patron family, we have a lot of things. We have some fun things planned for the holiday and some great things coming up in the new year. So please join us. And thank you again. Join me again soon as we keep shaking up history together. Thank you.